Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
Hello, my children, and welcome to the Covenstead podcast. It is I, your host and partner in crime in this journey of discovery, Todd the Fearsome. And with me, as always, is my cohort and partner in undeath, Danny. Say hello, Danny.
Hello.
I couldn't help myself.
Was that scary or creepy? I guess we'll have to let the listeners decide if that was scary or creepy.
You're hearing the version that's not going to be, like, you know, tweaked and modulated and stretched out and all this other kind of stuff. So who knows what we'll do with it. Yes. Anyways, yes. Welcome to Covenstead, everybody. I'm Todd. And here we have Danny here, of course, as always. And, yes, as you can imagine, we are finally going to start talking. This is going to be the first of our, what we plan to be an ongoing series on genres, you know, particularly with how to apply them in RPGs. But yeah, we really like the idea of spending an episode talking about individual genres, subgenres, anything like that, that can port over into a whole different selection of games. Mm-hmm. And we are starting with Danny's absolute favorite, and the one that we had to start with.
Horror games!
Yes. And I want to apologize in advance. I have a nasty habit of missing an R sometimes when I say horror. So if it sounds like I'm saying whore, it's horror. I will try and fix it at editing if I have to, but that is a risk when we're talking about the genre.
Yes, so we're talking about your Call of Cthulhu's, your Cult Divinity, your Dreads, your, gosh, you know, and even if you do other games, you
Bluebeard's Bride.
Bluebeard's Bride. We're talking Little Fears. We're talking all sorts of all the games that, you know, you get into to be scared and how those work. And I think any discussion of horror needs to start with, as opposed to any other genre, the horror role-playing game genre of all of them requires, more than ever, all games can use safety tools. But since horror really does have, more than most other genres, a lot of the things that are going to upset people at the table, or could potentially upset people at the table, or make them uncomfortable, or remind them of bad things, safety tools are so important. And I want to stress that first, before you start talking about how to scare your players. Safety tools are the biggest thing. You need to know how far to go.
Yes.
And not cross over that line. So when you're doing horror. And you have to also understand that when you're doing horror and you do safety tools, there aren't 100% guarantees that you're going to cover everything. So you have to have a plan in place where something unexpectedly makes somebody uncomfortable that you hadn't talked about for whatever reason. And you need to have a plan for that. So safety tools, lines and veils before the game, a way to talk about stuff during the game if it happens, and all of that stuff is super important for horror. Because we're talking about stuff that traumatizes people. We're talking about stuff that horrifies people. We're talking about stuff that scares people. We're talking about stuff that gives people less sleep, you know? So that's super important. And I wanted to stress that first before we give you tools to scare people.
Yeah. And it's really important with that, because you have to think of it that horror is a very specific genre to a very select number of people. It is not something for everybody. And you have to think of it as that people who go to a horror film, read a Stephen King novel or something like that, you know, they gave their consent when they walked through the door and or bought the book or whichever the case may be. So safety tools are kind of that way of making sure that everyone's going to be on the same page and what you are and aren't going to do. Like, I have a thing about eyes. It doesn't bug me descriptively, visually, definitely. Any kind of horror film I've seen that has anything to do with eyeballs, it's a definite look away from me, you know. Heights is another thing that can be really tricky for me. So if it's going to be in there, I still want it to be noted that it's just like, okay, it doesn't bug me if suddenly my character is dangling off the side of a building. Wow, even now I am grabbing the side of my desk yeah. and holding on for dear life. That just goes to show how much of a strong emotion I get out of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind if that's a description that's in the game, but I want it to be noted that it's like, let's not push that button too hard.
Too hard.
You know? Yeah. So yeah, consent for this. Yeah, consent for these kind of things can be a big deal because it. I have actually seen it happen where you're suddenly, you've lost a player and you start to worry about whether or not you've lost a friend at the same time, which is totally not worth it. Totally right. not. So, yes. That being said, I think if there is anything, Danny, that comes up here in this conversation, I will make a note of it. And maybe we'll even kind of put like a little content warning in advance just right. in case we happen to get into the... Because just thinking about what the last episode, somebody out there may have a fear of actually being beaten to death inside their sleeping bag. And we were just right. laughing and huffing about it in right. the last episode. You never know actually when it comes to this stuff. Right. So yeah, no, that's a really good point to start
yeah.
with.
Yeah. And the most common ones that are usually outright on the game are sexual assault and stuff with kids and pets. Those are the biggest ones that I always get as lines and veils. Very common. And you don't need them to do horror. You don't. You really don't. And, yeah. and so, you know, it, and those are the big ones usually, that I find, when I do this with horror games, and I will know I've said this before, but especially in horror, my philosophy of being a service top GM of, I will hurt you. I will scare you. I will do awful things to you, but you have to want me to, right? You know, it has to be. Yeah, you know, you have to want me to make you cry, you know, in order for me to do that. So that's what I try to live by and everything. But all that being said, I know everyone listening is going to make sure that their players are super comfortable with whatever horror, you know, is going to be happening. You know, horror is my favorite, but what about you with horror games? Like, what's your experience with horror games, and what do you like about them or don't like about them?
Well, horror as a genre, for me, it's always been in films. You know, like, I was a film student, so that even after I dropped out, horror films were always kind of like the professional student film. Like, the ones that really captivated me was the original Evil Dead, because that was literally made by people like me at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, borrowing the film department's cameras for the weekend, yeah. you know, and doing stuff that no insurance is going to yeah. cover with those things, yeah. you know, kind of stuff like that. So to me, I used to really be into watching slasher films for the most part. The idea of zombie films were a really big thing before The Walking Dead came along. And then I felt like it got kind of a little oversaturated. But those were the ones that really got me, where the emphasis was kind of more on like the gore and everything like that. As far as games, however, I haven't really experienced them too much. So I did just finish a very short, like, 4-session arc of Knights Black Agents. I just finished that, which, you know, we just talked about in the last episode. Before then, I think the only thing... Oh, I also have played and run in a game of my friend Jacob Wood's Survival of the Able. That's the one where you play people with disabilities during the 12th century, and there's a zombie outbreak. Mm-hmm. And before that, I played a game called Horror Rules. And I remember this very vividly because on the cover is a toilet with like these green tentacles coming out. So kind of like if you remember the cover of Chuds, mm-hmm. and how there's like one of these little goblin creatures coming out the toilet, mm-hmm. that but tentacles. And that was a comical horror game, mm-hmm. or at least we definitely played it that way. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I don't really have a lot of experience with horror games. It's just never something that's really kind of come up. But I also think most of the players that I've played with so far have never really been into that. Like, you know, horror is not their thing. Mm-hmm. Or that intense level of role playing, I think that is expected from a horror game. I think it's just been it's just never kind of interested the table, so it's never come up before. So I'm a rookie.
Yeah. Unlike me, I guess. I'm kind of the opposite. I mean, most games I've played have been horror. Most of the ones I've run have been horror, or they turn into that. I mean, I had my vampire game that's been going on. We're getting to the finale. Can you believe it? It's been like 4 years this game has been going on. Two years. Ooh. I'm sorry. Okay. We're getting to the end, the climax, and all of that. But even that, I mean, you think vampire is kind of horror, but it's White Wolf, so it's angsty kind of, you know what I mean? Like, ours has kind of ended up CW-ish in a lot of way. Yeah. But they wanted to ramp it up, and they asked for a Zemisi in the game. And so we did that, and we had a heck of a lot of body horror and some real horror stuff going on with my Toreador character doing aura perception and clairvoyance and stuff like that on objects and getting all these horrific images and everything like that. So even games that I don't fully intend to be horror end up being a little horrific sometimes. And I guess what I love about it, I mean, I love all horror. I love horror movies. I love horror books. The horror games, horror role-playing games specifically, I'm not talking about like video games or books or movies that you experience for horror, but tabletop role-playing games themselves in horror are a much more interactive and much more visceral experience, in my opinion. Because, you know, you're there, you're going through it, you're voicing dialogue, you're in the moment, and it to me has a much more visceral reaction than, you know, watching a movie or reading a book or playing a video game. Video games would be next in terms of that. But I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, you being able to interact with it. You know, there's not that distance of a movie or book, you know, where you're watching other person, but with a video game, and then especially with a role-playing game, you're interacting with it, which makes it different than a lot of other horror experiences, okay? And plus, I find, in terms of what you're going for, and horror at tabletop role-playing games and horror benefit the most. All games benefit, I feel like, from soundtracks, from atmosphere, from everything like that, depending on what you're doing. But I find that horror, more than any other genre, really benefits from that. You know, a darkened room, but not too dark. Nobody can read. But dark, you know, music going, some incense, you know, all of that sort of stuff. If you're doing it in person, I find really have a great effect. Or if you're doing it online, you know, put on a cloak or something and darken your background, you know, like make it look and feel what they're going to be getting into. And I find that that's a helpful way to help that mood that you're trying to go after. Yeah. So that's another thing that I find about horror. Safety tools and atmosphere are really super important for this particular genre, I find, if you're going to be doing it.
Yeah. That reminds me, one of the games I should have mentioned was Ravenloft, mm-hmm. which was also something I mentioned in the last episode. And going to that atmosphere that in the 90s, I remember TSR came out with each of their campaign settings got a CD. And the Ravenloft one was really cool.
Nice.
Because it came as part of an adventure. And so all the box text room descriptions were read by a professional actor with sound effects and all this other kind of stuff on there.
Nice.
And then there were additional sound effects that you could just add to the tracks, you know. So, and there was a good enough assortment based on the various things that were in there that you could just throw out, put on a loop sometimes. It was really well done. In fact, the quality was so good. I remember we were playing down in my friend's basement and a creaking stair sound effect came on the CD. And we thought it was someone coming down the creaky basement stairs. So we all just turned and looked. And there was nobody there. And while we knew what happened, you know, it's like, oh, the radio did that. It was still like a, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of moment of, like, as if each one of us suddenly expected, you know, a ghost to just suddenly appear, you know. So, yeah, atmosphere can be a really, really big part that I find that, you know, it can be ported over to other genres. But with horror, it almost kind of demands it. It's like when you look at it from a filmmaking technique, you apply all the tricks of the trade. Mm-hmm. And even to, you get to get away with, like when you have a director like Sam Raimi, who is basically known for like tilting the camera at like, you know, very noticeable angles. It's one of those things where it's just like in a horror film, you can totally do it. You can get away with it. You can be experimental and, you know, try new ideas where it's like, well, we're not going to use music as a sound effect. I'm actually going to take this metal rod and I'm going to scratch it across this piece of steel. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to mix that and we're going to use that as the soundtrack for the movie. It's just like you could totally pull it off. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's the, and once again, I think that's kind of one of those reasons why I've never really been in a group where that kind of atmosphere was par for the course. Mm. And so sometimes I wonder, I think it gives this impression that LARPers are into horror games. You know, the people who can really immerse themselves into it. Mm. Is that something, do you find that with how you play? Is it a more immersive experience for you and the other players in the game? Or is it kind of like, no, I feel like I play it the same way. I'm just adapting to the genre.
I think it can be. Usually after we play games, you know, we're very chatty and all that stuff. But I found after a certain very horrifying, you know, it gets all quieter. There's a little bit more of an adjustment to come back to reality. So I think it affects people in a different way, in all honesty. So, you have to be aware of why people are playing that particular horror game to begin with. Is there catharsis there that's wanting to be done? They just want to be freaked out a little bit. What are they trying to achieve by playing the horror game? What sort of horror do they want? And those are all things that you can use that they're all going to buy into. So I do find that horror games tend to be more immersive. Not that other games aren't. I just find that they tend to have a higher rate of bleed over than other games. Of bleeding over. And they require a lot more debriefing and stuff. You know, it just does. Because we're tapping into, you know, very primal kind of feelings. You know, not just like, I'm overcoming obstacles and we're frustrated and we have to find the courage deep down. This is very different than that. And images can stay with you for sure. And so, yeah, safety tools, atmosphere, big deal. Knowing what kind of horror they want specifically is going to be helpful just like in any other game. I find... Yeah. Getting into tools and how to run a horror game, I guess. So would that be a good topic? Do you have other, I talk about how I run a horror game or how I do to create feelings of dread, how I go about doing that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd like to hear that kind of stuff because, I mean, it is one of the things that fascinates me, I think, the most about role-playing games, but a lot of tabletop games, but RPGs specialize in this, is the idea that you're taking elements of play and invoking an emotional reaction beyond just fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in this particular case, it's about creating some level of fear in the players because that's what they're looking for. And yeah, I would love to get your take on your strategies and your approaches.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, like, what are some of your go-tos? Like, you know, a lot of GMs have their strategies when they run certain games or certain genres or anything. Is there anything that you do in your prep work for horror games that you find kind of like define your GMing style?
I like to find things that, like, if I'm prepping and I'm looking at how am I gonna scare these folks, right? I find that instead of trying to scare all of them or trying to, like, if I have a particular thing, instead of it trying to insert fear or insert a certain uncomfortable emotion or uncomfortability in all the characters, I will usually find something that will speak to one character that I have, right? I find, as a general rule, in horror games, so here's my down and dirty Danny tricks for horror games. Feel free to use. They have worked for me 60% of the time, all the time. So here we go. One.
And we'll have link to Danny's book.
How to run a horror game. One is make it personal for the character. That more than anything else, not more than anything else, but that works. You make it personal for that character. Usually if they're playing a horror game, players, there is something there that you can feed off of. That you can feed off of. Some part of that character's past or personality or fear or whatever that you can choose, right?
Mm.
And when you find that thing and you use it, I find that rather than making just in a general, like, oh, you walk into a room and there's bodies hanging everywhere. And they've been skinned and they're hanging and dripping from the ceiling. Okay, that's horrifying to a certain extent, right? It is, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it just is. And you're looking at it and you're like, wow, that's gross and that's creepy and everything like that. But then they recognize some items that are on the floor. Now you're bringing it up a level. Now these aren't just random dead bodies. These are people they know, or people they knew, or things they recognize. Yeah. Make it personal. That is one of my tenets that I go by. Make it personal for the character. Avoid the character versus the player, but make it personal. Add that personal touch of the thing that is going to... That little bit extra. Think of a horrific scene and then add a little bit extra to make it personal to something that you know would get to one of the characters. Like, let's say one of your characters in a horror game is a mother or a parent who their kid has been taken by some demon or whatever happens to be in the world. And that's how they got involved in this. Make it personal. Make one of these things a kid's item. Not necessarily they kid, but they can have the horror of thinking, what if this is? And then realizing it isn't, but it's somebody's kid, right? Make it something that character is going to hit them. Take a horrific scene and add something a little personal that is going to disturb a character.
Especially if it's something that the player created as part of the mm-hmm. game. And that's where... questions can be real. I find, personally speaking, having some questions that you can just kind of throw out there at random moments to, you know, that you can then draw from later on. It's just like, okay, what's something I could use to spook this character with? That whole thing takes me back to the movie The Changeling, mm-hmm. the 1979 version with George C. Scott. And in that one, he is a widower who had lost his wife and child in a tragic accident, moves to this big, you know, haunted house and is being you know, haunted by a ghost. And the ghost is using his connection to his daughter in the form of a small bouncy ball that just keeps appearing. It's like a keepsake that he has, but the ghost seems to kind of play with it and all this other kind of stuff. And that, if you look at it being something that the player playing George C. Scott's character was asked, what is something that you have that reminds you of your daughter every time? And it's like, it's just a small red and blue bouncy ball with a white stripe going up the middle. And then you take that and you use that, and that gets the player into it, because it to me, I think, especially in the horror genre, it creates this sense of inescapability that, you know, I find horror likes to really drench itself in. I'm just like, oh, no, you think you could come up with something that I won't scare the shit out of you with? No. Watch this, you know. So, yeah, that's a really good way of, you know, making things personal. I like that approach. Nice.
Personal is super important. And this is, I mean, it's stuff that we do in other games, too. You know, weaving in backstories and stuff like that. But as I said, with setting and safety tools, I feel like with horror, it's even more so important to add that personal. Because often, horror, often, so often, like 90% of the time, the horror is about the characters. Like most stories, it's about the character and what they're going through that's horrifying, right? The second thing that I always try to do that has worked great benefit to me is less is more sometimes. Sometimes you don't need that big gory scene. Sometimes you don't need, you know, the big creature that's dripping and drooling and after them or this, you know. You don't need it. You don't need it. Sometimes the most horrific thing is the characters sitting in a room discussing what they're going to be doing, right? And they're talking and they're sitting there and the characters are saying, man, you know, we need to get, you know, what is going on here? We found these letters or whatever they're talking about, and they're being real urgent, right? And then all of a sudden you pipe in quietly and you say, you hear the creak of a door. That's it. And now the players are like, wait, what? Where? You heard the creak of a door from somewhere. We look around, you know, like sometimes you don't need the big thing. You need the little thing, like a bouncy ball just bouncing through the, you know, the hallway. Sometimes you just need the door opening slightly. Sometimes you just need a little reflection in the mirror or a piece of clothing laying somewhere, or the smallest drops of blood on a windowsill. Less is more sometimes. Do not be tempted to go for like the big, you know, intense, gory, whatever, confrontational horror all the time. Sometimes the power is in the small little things that happen that that are the most unsettling for the players. Because for the third thing is buildup. It is so important to build. You got to build. You are not going to start out horrified, right? You're not. You may start out a little creeped out, your characters. You may start out a little apprehensive, right? But you aren't really going to start a game horrified. It is your job as the GM to build that up, right? Don't be afraid to build. Use little things. Use anticipation. Use false alarms. Use the player's paranoia and what they're checking out against them. Let things build. Let them build. Make it personal. You don't always need the big to do, and let it build. And you do that by adding in those little things that they, and don't be afraid, the other one that I have is don't be afraid to let the players do the work for you. All right, because oftentimes they can freak themselves out, right? You know, they can freak themselves out with stuff that's there, and you don't even have to do anything. If you built up and everything, and you're just describing a room, sometimes they'll latch on to something, right? And you know it means nothing. Like, they go into a room and they see a music box, and they're like, oh my god, this music box. It's super creepy. It's just, it's a music box. It's a kid's room. It's nothing that you would plan for the game, right? But why not let them stress about it for a little while, right? Why not, instead of saying, no, you don't find anything, why not stretch it out a little, right? Why not? Like, I'm going to go over and pick up the music box. Instead of being like, okay, roll. All right, there's nothing. Why not narrate it out a little bit, right? Okay, you pick up the box, the music box. It's pink. It's got some gold trim. It's got a ballerina. Looks like it's been worn on it, you know, from being played and held. You've got some designs of animals around the outside in gold. You know, start describing it, right? Let them be like, there's a key on the side to turn the music box on. A gold key. You know? Okay, I turned the key. You know? It plays a tune and maybe start humming something, right? You know, and they're waiting. They're waiting for something to happen. See if something creepy. And it's not going to. But build up that anticipation in that scene to think it might. You know what I mean? I mean, usually you want your characters to kind of move on quickly to what they need to do. But sometimes in horror, it's perfectly fine to let them kind of go down a little red herring rabbit hole and psych themselves out and wonder. Because if you let them wonder, and sometimes it's something, sometimes it's not, they're always going to wonder, right? So that kind of builds up that tension and that anticipation of something horrifying happening.
Yeah. A technique I've used before, you know, kind of very much playing up on that kind of stuff. But one of the things that I've tended to add in, actually with a lot of D&D that I've run before, is to just add a really odd detail in the middle of something that just makes the player go, why did you mention that? You know, because it's just like, you know, despite all the ornate details and, you know, it's, for example, with the music box you were mentioning, I would potentially add on to there. It's just like, and as you pick it up and lift it, for a brief moment, it appears to be stuck. And then suddenly it releases itself. You hear like a tiny little click and it just releases. And then, you know, a lot of players I play with, because especially too, in a lot of, you know, D&D style games and everything else like this, and the traditional adversarial GMs, a lot of those players are very susceptible to, hold on a sec, that's not right. Something's afoot. I smell a trap. And instead of backing away, they actually lean into it. And just little details like that to kind of disorient a player, mm-hmm. of just to kind of drop their ire, their suspicion that something is wrong, something's afoot, when it turns out it's absolutely nothing. You know, like, why did the box stick? I don't know, it's been sitting there for 150 years. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And just let their imaginations kind of get a little wild on them, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, and another trick that I like to use often is contrast. Something horrifying in the middle of something that you don't think would be horrifying, right? Something that ostensibly seems fine. Right? That they wouldn't expect. And then all of a sudden you hit them with something horrifying. Right? This is kind of a trope in movies. Often they use kid rooms and things like that for that sort of thing. You know, you've got a kid's drawing that's creepy. You know, stuff like that. You know. But, you know, I like to get creative and find how many mundane or non-scary things can we make scary, right? Can we make kind of horrifying and trepidatious? How many things are actually horrifying that we don't consider to be horrifying, you know, initially? You know, there's lots of terms of horror kind of pushing that genre, of putting it in places where you wouldn't expect, right? And I always love that. You know, I love that where you find things that you wouldn't necessarily expect. There's a great book called Horror Store by Grady Hendrix. And it is a horror novel that takes place in an IKEA-like store. And it is fantastic. You know, take something like a, you know, like an Office Depot or something like that. Make it horrifying. You know, take anything that you would normally consider things that aren't usual and make them horrifying. People do that with bathrooms, with schools, with playgrounds, with, you know, things that we associate with other stuff. And make them scary, you know, or things that we don't engage with in that way a little bit. So contrast can also work to be unsettling and give that kind of horrific feel, you know, for sure.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, and it contrast is one of those things. When you do things like that, I'm really curious about, do you kind of start off small as far as that level of contrast and then make it build as things progress? Or is it just kind of you seize the moment as soon as you see it? Like, how do you normally apply that when you're running?
Sometimes if my whole setting is that, you know, I'll build it up, you know. But sometimes you can get great effect from them walking into a place that ostensibly looks non-horrifying, but it's got this one horrifying element in it. You know what I mean? One time, a long time ago, I did a vampire game that I made to be horrific, and they were going through a carnival, right? Now, ostensibly, carnivals are not unused to being getting the horror treatment. Okay, carnivals, you know, have had that treatment before. But I used, I would have ostensibly look normal looking things with something horrific in it. There was kind of like this little ice skating rink thing at the carnival. And ostensibly they went and were, you know, trying to get across it. And they realized underneath that there were bodies in the ice after a few minutes of them crawling. It looked completely fine as they were doing it. But then one of them tripped and fell. And when they fell, they looked in the ice and they were face to face with a body in the ice. And then they started pushing away and saw more and more bodies in the ice. So they were fine for a little while. It looked like just this rink that they were trying to get across to the other side. And then it turns into horrifying, right? So you can get some mileage out of having it be a surprise, ostensibly on the surface. But then when you look closer, it's horrifying, right? You find a little girl wearing a dress. Oh, that's certainly cute, that dress. You know, looks cute, little girl in a dress or a little kid in a dress, whatever. And then, you know, you're interacting with this kid and then you realize that the dress is actually sewn together with different like body stuff, like the buttons are teeth and stuff like that, that you didn't notice until you got closer. Right. So things on the surface that look fine and then horrifying underneath, can be a good surprise effect to that effect of contrast. You can build it up slowly, or you can have it be like on first glance and then all of a sudden it turns horrifying when you look closer. Can be done to great effect as well. Like one buildup that you can do, and what buildup does is it leads them into a false sense of security, right? In that same game, I had a ball pit, a series of ball pits, right? First, and they, by this, they'd already had some horrifying stuff happen. So they get in this ball pit, and they're ready for it, right? They're ready. They're ready for something horrifying to be in here. But there wasn't. It was a completely normal ball pit.
Yeah.
So then they go along, there's another ball pit, and they go, and they start freaking out because somebody finds a limb, right? But then they find out the limb's just a mannequin limb. It's not a person. Okay. So now they're like, what the hell? You know, so now I built it. Now they were like, oh, a ball pit. Oh, now a ball pit. But oh shit, it has a leg. Oh wait, that's not a real leg. The third one definitely had some body parts, some real body parts in it. So you built it up, right? And so they never knew what it was going to be next. So in that case, you build up something out of context, right? they interact with it a couple times and it's not really horrifying, or it builds up to be more and more horrifying until finally they were in a ball pit of limbs and blood.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you can do it both ways. I hope that answered your question. You can do it both depending on what sort of effect you're going for.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was very curious to see, well, I mean, like, what's one of your most kind of favorite ways that you scared or even kind of like, you know, disturbed the players? Because having something that might not be scary, but it's still disturbing, it's unsettling, you know, the concept, the idea of something behind it, can still be really effective for that. You know, like, is there one incident in particular where it really, like, it really surprised you, just like, oh wow, that really got a stronger reaction than I was expecting? Is there one that comes to mind?
Yeah, there is one where I had, I'm trying to think of how to start the story because there's a lot of context.
Okay.
Short story is, my vampires went into this house of the Giovanni. They didn't know what had happened here, but something had happened. And they ended up finding, this is when the Zamisi showed up in the vampire game that they had requested. So this is how I introduced, they went into this house expecting to deal with Giovanni. There were no Giovanni, but there was a coffin in the hallway as a present for the prince. And they went and dealt with that. They found inside the coffin, they were kind of freaked out. They're trying to make sure it wasn't a trap or anything. They're trying to figure out. Finally, they open it and they see like the twisted vision, you know, body of like the head of the Giovanni clan in their city in there. And they're like, oh crap, that's really horrifying. You know, so they were pretty disturbed by that. They were like, what the heck? But what I didn't anticipate was a long effect horror. This was in the second season. We're now on the fourth, okay?
Okay.
Near the beginning of the fourth season, what they had done with it, they had taken the coffin and they had put it in their house that they were kind of using at a base. They didn't know what else to do with it. And the body was still in there, and then they got involved in other things. So this body has been sitting in there, and they would remind themselves of it every once in a while when they went back to the house, you know, like, oh yeah, the coffin's still here. And so it was kind of there and they just didn't know. They're like, well, you know, should we dispose of the body? But, you know, and all this other stuff. But, you know, then they had more important things to deal with. But there came a point, and I had intended for them to find this out right away, but they didn't. But it came to the point where they realized that that vampire was still conscious inside that twisted body the whole time. 2 seasons later. Oh. And they're horrified of all the times they'd walked by it and this person had been trapped inside and they had done nothing about it. Had a bigger effect than I had anticipated, because I hadn't anticipated that being a reveal later on, but it was. And nice. Then when it came out, they were pretty horrified by what they had done. Not necessarily by anything I had done, but that they had ignored it for so long. And this person had been in there for months or whatever, just trapped inside this twisted body this Amici had mangled. So, yeah, that was one that had an unintended. I didn't expect it to have a long-term horrifying effect, but it did.
And what the beauty of that, as I'm taking from it, is that that's all them. That wasn't something that you kind of forced them to do or not do. It was just kind of like, it was totally their call. And that's kind of one of there's two takeaways I'm getting from everything you've mentioned here so far. One is, it really seems like you're guiding their hand a lot more. And even two, from what I've heard from, you know, other designers who have made horror games, is that you really don't have to. You know, like, one of the things that often the standard trope in, like, a, you know, your traditional kind of, you know, fantasy style game is, you meet at a tavern, someone comes up to you and gives you a quest. You know, with horror, you don't necessarily need that. They'll bite the hook almost every single time. So it almost kind of seems like as long as you're providing them with those horrific beats, you're really just kind of guiding them along. And they'll give you stuff to make creepy and everything else like that. And the other thing I'm getting from this. Yeah. The other thing I'm getting from this too is that it really kind of seems like if you get the players to really like their characters, like become attached to their characters, then you can really kind of make the potential horror of what could happen to that character a lot more real. That was something I really mm-hmm. noticed in the last session we had of Knights Black Agents. The character who I was playing, Nikki, I had actually kind of grown attached to the idea and the concept of this character and the rapport that Jacob and I had between our two characters. Very much kind of, you know, like, you know, misfit vampire hunters sort of stuff. That, and there was kind of like a buddy cop kind of element to it, because my quest was to actually hunt demons and his was to hunt vampires. So we help each other out. And from time to time, we get into arguments as to whether or not it's a vampire or a demon. And what was cool is that the Phil, the GM, actually kind of did bring that in. It's just like, you know, and did actually bring in a demon for us to deal with, too. So, but it was my attachment to the character, because I enjoyed Nikki when it really seemed like Nikki was like up Schitt's Creek. I really kind of felt it just like, no, I don't want something bad to happen to Nikki. I like Nikki. Nikki's totally fictional. Right. He's not real in any way, shape, or form. I don't even have a picture of what he could look like. But having that attachment really brought me into it. And even then, I found I played more like I was in a horror game instead of in an action game, which can really be blurred in Knights Black Agents, potentially. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, those are kind of two takeaways I'm getting from everything you've mentioned, which, sweet.
Right.
Nice.
And my super advanced tip is if you can make a consequence of something they've done or some decision they make horrifying, you are so much better, because things are horrifying on their own. But if it's horrifying because of a decision you made, that's even worse. So, you know, for instance, in my vampire game, my Ventru character, his goal that they have built the relationship, he's been there since day one, and they have built up this relationship, and now they have this unrequited love thing going on. Like, it's a deep relationship that they have, this ghoul, now vampire and vampire. So, and it's been building and building and building. And now that ghoul, that vampire, is in danger and has been kidnapped. And this is not a horror game, but this was horrifying, mostly because he got in that position because of a decision that my player character made. My player character made the decision to screw with his sire's other childer and erase their memory and do a whole bunch of stuff to this person's childer, to their sire's childer. All right. And as a result, their sire turned around and went and did the same, or is trying to do the same thing to his childer, the one that he is super, super attached to and has a relationship with. So the fact that the vampire is in danger is bad enough, right? But the fact that the reason that happened is because of a choice and actions that my player character took makes it all that more horrifying, because now I'm adding the guilt onto whatever horrific torture is happening to that vampire right now.
Yeah, so it seems like player agency is like a big part of the horror RPGs, where, you know, you kind of, you're feeding off of what they give you. It's very kind of writer's table in that sense, where it's like, you could run the same scenario 3 to 5 times and each one will always come out different, because you're feeding off of what the other players are giving you through their characters and everything else like that. And I mean, player agency in and of itself is another safety tool. It's just one that is normally far more baked in. You know, there's normally not a whole section about how to add player agency to your game. It's almost all the time, it seems, added, baked right into it. Safety tools are a separate section because they have to be explained, the concept and how to apply them and everything else like that. So I think that's one of the ways that safety tools maybe gets kind of like a bit of a bad rap of just like, you know, I quote unquote don't need it or anything. But player agency is always something that's kind of a built-in safety tool when you think about it, because you're automatically not going to push a boundary if the players don't take it into that boundary, so to speak.
Right. As kind of a corollary to that, like consequences of their actions becoming horrifying, really adding to that, a subgenre or a subnote or a kind of side of that is giving them what they need or want, but in a horrifying manner. Okay. Let's say they know that they need, we're going to be real body horrors gross, right? Like, let's say they need an eyeball to throw on an altar to stop this demon or whatever. And they're like, crap, we need an eyeball, right? Well, then their friend dies. One of the player character dies. Well, now we've got an eyeball. Okay, like, give them what they need or want, yeah, but in a horrifying way or a way that they probably did not want that to come about. And that is horrifying. You know what I mean? A good template for this is Wishmaster. If you ever saw the Wishmaster movies, you know.
No, but I think I remember the VHS box, actually. But well, I've the never
Wishmaster
seen it.
Was about a djinn who, you know, grants wishes and stuff. And one of the ones that sticks out is this woman wishes that she was beautiful forever, that she wouldn't grow old and her beauty would stay the same. And so he turned her into a mannequin. You know, if you can pull off something like that, give them something they're looking for or something they want, but in a horrifying manner, well, then you're going to be better off. So that's kind of a corollary of the consequences of their actions. If you make the horrifying stuff a decision that they have make or something they need or wanted or asked for, you're just amping that up. You're just amping that up, and they will be horrified, in my experience.
It's been so long since I've seen any of the episodes, but as a kid, I remember watching some of the episodes of The Twilight Zone, the original black and white series. My grandmother used to watch it. She loved that show. And that was really, the writing on that was so good because the things that the characters would go through was always so personalized. And it was always like, when you finally got to the end and you see, you know, what's really going on or what it is that they now have to live with or, you know, the consequences of their action, whatever the case may be, it's just like so spot on. And that was, that show was really, really good at doing that stuff, I remember.
Oh, yeah. The classic one that everybody remembers is the one with Burgess Meredith as the guy who just wanted to read books. Did you remember that? Do you remember that one?
Yes. Yeah. I remember the Simpsons version of it, I think, actually.
And all he wants is time to read books, right. And all he wants is to read books. The apocalypse happens, so now he has all this time, but his glasses break. And now he actually can't read. So if you can manage, if you kind of do stuff like that, you're going to be all the better off in the end by making it, the result, not what they wanted, be careful what you wish for sort of thing is a really good tool to use to amp that up for sure. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it is one of those things where, like with my online group, because it's an opportunity for all of us to try out some new stuff, but it's also something I want to start GMing some stuff. So there are some games that, you know, are very horror-based or more so kind of, they might be more post-apocalyptic or some other kind of genre, but I want to run them as a horror game. So there's one actually called Belly of the Beast. I got this one years ago. And the entire concept is that there's just giant Leviathan swallowed up a large chunk of the world. And so, like, this entire village, community, province, you know, like, the size of this Leviathan is basically kind of unlimited, is all now living inside the belly of this gigantic, gargantuan beast. And these are survivors. So to me, it was always initially very post-apocalyptic. I've been thinking about tossing that out to the group at some point, and if I did, I would very much want to start kind of applying a horror tone to the game. And, you know, basically using the sights and sounds and the things, the choices that people have to make and the horrific consequences of those choices just to stay alive, kind of thing like that, is something I've been thinking. So, yeah, having a better idea of, like, these kind of techniques. One question I do have for you, and then, because even I'm noticing the time, I know we're going to start running a little long. So we're going to get ahead of the curve and let everybody know. Guess what? We're running long. Do you consider, as the GM, that you're kind of, you know, trying to manipulate the players into, you know, well, I definitely want them to head towards that door, but I want them to choose to head towards that door? Do you kind of consider yourself to be kind of, you know, like you're using these various techniques to basically kind of manipulate the players into kind of reaching these intended objectives? Or is it really more for you, you know, like I just get to sit back and I just get to let them, you know, react to these wild and wacky things that are going on? Because I've always seen horror directing as you're manipulating the audience, you're focusing their attention a certain way, you're misleading them so many times, you know. So I wonder, do you feel that same way when it comes to GMing?
Well, this is where movies and books and all of that differ from GMing. In that, yeah, with a movie and book, you have complete 100% control of that. When you're running a game, you have the wild cards that is the players. And so how I get around this, how I get around this is a trick that I talked about when we were talking about GM styles and GMing and tips and all that stuff. And what I do is if I have something for whatever reason that I want to happen or something for them to discover, I wait for the opportunity to put it in there. Like, that's it. If I want them to have an encounter where they see a bathtub filled with blood, let's say, right? I will wait for an opportunity to throw that in there. Like, I won't try and force them to what I feel like the bathroom is, you know what I mean? So that they can open the door and see a tub, you know? I will just be like, okay, we open this door and everything. Oh, you find the bathroom. And in the bathroom, there is a tub full of blood. So I tend to think of my horror tricks and stuff as more list of things that happen that I pick and choose from and place where they're going to fit in context, okay? Rather than trying to force things to happen in a certain way or at a certain place or at a certain time, I will wait for that opportunity for that thing to happen, right? If I have a note I need to find, where that note is going to be is going to depend on where they're looking and how they're, you know, how they're doing things. You know, maybe it'll be behind a mirror that they check behind. Maybe it'll be underneath a dresser that they move. But wherever it is, it's going to be somewhere that they've chosen to look on their own via their own reasons. So I create the illusion that it was there the whole time. I guess is what you could say.
Okay, yeah.
I create the illusion that it was there the whole time.
That I can get behind because that's like the old D&D trope of if the fantastic room with the, the terrifying monster that you really want them to fight is on the left and they go to the right, guess what? Terrifying monster is now on the right.
Right.
Just move things around. If they won't go where you need them to go, you put it there for them. I can get behind
you. And I figure logically players know this happens, but for whatever reason, it doesn't matter to them. Yeah. Because in the moment, it feels organic. It feels like this was supposed to happen now. And why? Because that was the organic way that they did things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's called kind of the floating key method, where the lock is good. The key's there floating, where the lock's going to be is going to depend, So basically I come up with, if I'm planning beforehand a horror game, I will just generate a list of creepy shit that can happen, right? Or creepy stuff that will build up that can happen, and like a list of things they might need to know to get the story, right? And what they are just lists. And I might even have some ideas of where there's things could be. You know, I'll be like, oh, this might be in a drawer somewhere. You know, this is like a photo. So it can be leaning against the wall, facing a wall somewhere, or hanging somewhere. Or it can be hidden in the back of a wardrobe, right? I'll have some idea of the types of places I could put that sort of thing. And then I just wait. I just wait. I know they need to have it by the end of the session. I know they need this information by the end of the session for the story to go on. So I just wait for one of those appropriate places to put it in, right?
Okay.
You know, and then, oh, they're going down this hallway. This is the perfect time for me to put this creepy thing in that I thought could happen, right?
Okay. All righty then. I think the other thing I'm getting from your approach to it is that you're a very cooperative GM in a horror game, which is something I didn't expect, because to me, I guess I had always expected that that was a genre where the idea of a more adversarial GM was, you know, permitted, expected kind of thing. But yeah, I think that's definitely a misconception that I've had going into it, is that you're working with the players to create this atmosphere because, you know, they'll embrace it. They want to play a horror game, so they'll embrace it. They'll make sure that this kind of stuff happen. You need
use
to just
their
basically
background,
give them
use
the bird
their
seed.
Choices. Yeah. Yeah, use yeah. their background, use their choices, use what they're already doing organically to throw stuff in there. And that's going to give you a better effect. That is going to give you a better effect. Because if they feel like they were forced to do something, they're not going to be freaked out. They're just not. They're not going to get that feeling. So, you know, choice and all of that are usually, you know, can help you create that effect.
Yeah.
You know, that we've gotten ourselves in this situation and the horrifying things that have happened are at least partially our fault. It can be a powerful tool and motivator for getting yourself into a horror game that people are going to be talking about, for sure.
So remember when I was mentioning before about how I'm working on trying to build kind of like a fantasy a new version of campaign option mazes, where I want to kind of bring horror elements actually into this maze exploration fantasy game. After going through all this, I think I have an idea on a way that I could add it in. I want to kind of throw it past you, and then, you know, maybe we can call things from there. One of the things that the system currently provides for is that you need to take time and you need to rest. And in order to do that, you choose one person who basically needs to recover as part of that rest. And what they have to do is they tell a story about their life back home, someone they've lost. This system was initially built to replicate war dramas and everything else like that. So the idea of soldiers sitting around a campfire kind of thing easily ports over to fantasy adventurers gathered around a campfire in the middle of the dungeon kind of thing. Initially, mm-hmm. someone tells a story of something from back home. If the mazes actually takes that and then goes a little further with it and say, like, at the end of the story, the player then writes down, like, a physical memento or, you know, something that the GM can then take and kind of port in. Because what I'm thinking now is that mm-hmm. the maze is going to be haunted. It sees your darkest desires, your biggest fears, manifests them, brings them forward, and that kind of stuff. And so by having these moments where you kind of are providing the players with opportunity to say, talk about your character's past for a moment, let's learn something more about this person, and then we'll get into another fight. Personalize this character slowly over time, make them attached, you know, to the players and the table as a whole. But then those moments come back and kind of bite them in the butt. So, like, if you have a character who says, you know, like, I miss my daughter back home. You know, she always used to play with this red and blue ball with a white stripe down the middle and stuff like this. And then at the end of this moment, at this recollection, this role-playing moment, they write down on their character sheet, red and blue ball with a white stripe. And then the GM, all of a sudden, they're walking down the maze. They're, you know, in this corridor, not knowing what they're doing. And then all of a sudden, they just see this red, blue, and white striped ball just come rolling down the hallway towards them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What do you think? Yeah?
That's effective. That's effective. I would even say that if I were doing it, I wouldn't have them pick the thing or write it down. Like, they might know you might pick something from the backstory, set it up as part of the thing, and then just you as the storyteller are listening, and you pick something up. Why? Because what you want them to do is make the connection themselves, right?
Okay.
You don't want to have to tell them, right, that you want that dawning horror realization, right? Like, and so what you want to do is you'd be like, you hear a bouncing noise. Bong, 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 bong. And I'm like, what? You turn and look and you see a ball, right? And then, right? If you hadn't done that before, the player's going to go. And if they make that connection, if you give them that time, build up that tension, they're going to say, is it red and blue with a white stripe? And you're going to go, yes, as a matter of fact, it is red and blue with a white stripe. You get that horrifying realization of what it is and them putting it together themselves, which creates a better effect.
Nice. Okay. Cool, cool, cool. The other thing I was thinking of adding then onto that is that when a moment like that happens, like, you know, the ball comes bouncing down the hallway, that realization. And I'm not sure how at this point, but I'm toying with the idea of there being a mechanic that the player rolls to almost kind of randomly determine if the moment becomes more horrific, you know, or nothing. This is as intense as the moment gets. Or...
the intensity. Yeah.
Right. But randomly don't know when it's going to happen. And it's still kind of like a under the player's control kind of moment because they're the ones who would roll the dice. I mean... I'm still a big fan of rolling die behind the screen at certain times when you don't want them to know what it is, to kind of, you know, that kind of lack of control that players like by seeing the dice. Somehow they affect the roll. They look at it while it's rolling across the table. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was then something I wanted to think, because then that kind of creates the, once again, you know, like it's creating a bit of suspense and then really kind of leaping in on it. Because I'm very much a fan of designing in story beat possibilities into my games nowadays. Right. What do you think?
So, well, there are a few ways that I might go with that, right?
Okay.
There are a few ways I might go with that. I might go, that way that thing happens, the ball comes bouncing, and they have to do some kind of willpower or some kind of mental check to kind of contain their emotion at it. Right. And I would give the player an option of just giving into it as well. Right. I would give the player the option of like, are you just going to kind of let this moment happen? Or are you going to try to resist it having an effect on you? Right. If they don't, here's what I might do just to amp it up a little bit more. All right. Because I am like this. So what I would do is have them do that. Right. And each possibility would have some kind of number that they would have to reach or whatever. All right. And you can do it one of two ways. If you want to do the you don't know, that's fine. You know, you don't know whether you were able to do it or not. Or, you know, they do know whether they succeeded, right? One way you could do it would be to have the effect happen immediately. Like, if they don't do it, the effect immediately gets horrific, right? More horrific. Yeah. Like, now the ball has blood splatters on it as it's coming towards you, you know, or something like that. You make the vision more horrific. However, what I might do is you see the ball coming, you know, you hear a noise, you turn and you see a ball coming towards you. The player's like, well, is it red and blue with red stripes? As a matter of fact, it is. They're like, oh, shit, you know, they're like, oh, crap, you know, that's scary, right? I shouldn't have told that story, because now it's their responsibility. They're the ones that chose that story. So this is their choice. This is something that they have now dragged into the game. So you're adding that on, which is good. And then you say, okay, make a roll to see how well you handle this, right? So they do. And if it's me, I wouldn't tell them. The vision would just stop.
Right.
But the next time, it's either going to be the same vision or it's going to be more horrific depending on whether they succeeded or not. The vision will either stay the same or it'll get more horrific the next time depending on how well they handled it the first time. And if they know that they didn't handle it well, that's anticipation. Now you're playing the player against the character, against the atmosphere that's happening. Because the player knows that they didn't make that rule. They know that they didn't handle it well, but they don't know how that's going to play out in the future.
Yeah.
So now they're anticipating it. Now the next time they hear that ball, they're not going to know they're going to see when they turn around because they know they didn't handle it well the first time. So they don't know what sort of horrifying thing they're now going to see when they hear that noise. And you will be able to create an effect just by telling them you hear the sound of a ball bouncing.
Yeah.
And they won't know what they're going to turn around and see.
Okay. Yeah. I think I can mechanize that. Okay. Cool. There we go. Because, has been the part where I really feel like my inexperience with horror games in that sense is a bit of a weakness for me when it comes to designing. Because it is, it's an experience, and I don't have enough of it yet. So, I don't know about everyone else out there, but this was super helpful.
You're welcome. And whether or not you tell them the roll, like whether or not you want to do an eye roll behind a thing and to know if it's going to get worse or not, whether or not you do that, thinking about it, they'll still have that anticipation. They still won't know what's going to happen next time. Rather than having it right away, I would rather build that and have that period of time of them not knowing if it's going to be worse or if it's going to be the same. And if it's not going to be the same, how is it going to be worse when they turn around? Like that anticipation of knowing that something horrifying is going to happen or not is really effective.
Yeah. All right, sweet. Yeah, that I think a lot of those techniques, those are ones I definitely want to start applying both in GMing style, even too as a player, like, you know, because it is, as we've just established, very player driven. Because I know we, like in our online group, we've talked about doing some Call of Cthulhu. I'm really interested to kind of play an investigator going into kind of like deep horror and everything else like that. So, yeah, but also too, as a designer, kind of, you know, knowing those kind of approaches and then making sure that I'm creating something that will allow GMs like yourself in order to get going on it. So, cool. Excellent. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, to wrap it up, one of the best games that I ever did, and, you know, usually they say, you know, don't split up your party, etc., like that. But one of the best games that my players still talk about in Vampire was when their vampires met with the changelings. And in order to get what they wanted from the changelings, they had to go through what the changeling called the game of fear.
Okay.
So what they did where there were doors, and she called it that. So I built up anticipation. They say, you're going to have to play a game. So here's the thing. I already had the reputation of the Fae because now they don't know what's going to happen. They know Fae have dark undertones, okay? Fae can have very dark, you know, making you dance forever, all of that sort of stuff. So ostensibly, the Fairy Duchess was just like, let's play a game. And they're like, you know, they're already not wanting to do this because they have no idea what, you know, the Duchess is going to do. So I'm already building anticipation. Then she brings them into this room with a bunch of doors and tells them that this is called the Game of Fear. So now another unknown. Now they're playing a game of fear. They don't know. Is it my fear, your fear, whose fear? What are we doing?
Yeah.
Then she explains that they're each going to individually have to go into the room and face whatever is in there and come back out. So now, more unknown. Okay, now we don't know what we're going to see when we're in there. We have no way to know. They each picked a card. And what I did was I had them, she had a game deck. So even before the Game of Fear, they picked a deck of cards they picked, and they picked the Game of Fear out of the deck, which they always were going to do. But it gave them the illusion that there were other games in there that they could have played, but they picked this one. So, no, we picked the Game of Fear. Crap. So they went in individually, and then I bounced narration between the four of them of what they were experiencing in their Game of Fear. And they're in whatever they were facing inside that I tailored to each one of them and their particular character's fears of what was going to happen in the future. And I would make a point to stop when there was some kind of cliffhanger or some choice they were about to make. And then I would move on to somebody else so they could ponder that while I came back to them. Right?
Nice.
So I tried to keep that tension built by where I cut each story off. And by far, my players have said that was one of the better games of the campaign that they played, because it was all individual to them. And you just built that tension individually, not only within the game itself, but by the way I was storytelling it, by bouncing around and picking my moments to bounce to build that tension. You know, they'd see something, they'd be like, or they'd realize where they are. I'm like, you're walking around. You're walking down, you find yourself in a city of some kind, and you're walking down the street, and you turn a corner, and you see someone at the end of the alleyway, and I say, do I recognize them? And I'd be like, you do. It's, and in this particular case, I said, it's your Bruja lover who's dead, standing at the end of the hallway. And then I cut it there. Yeah. I stopped. Like, just at that realization of what it was. So that they can ponder that while I went to the other people and narrated what was happening with them. So leave it at a reveal. Leave it at a choice. You know, like, what is it going to be? You know, someone talking to them. What's it going to be? And let them ponder those things for a little bit. Let them marinate a little bit in that. And like I said, that was one of the better ones I've done. And it was all about playing into those fears. So... That was the last story I wanted to tell.
Cool. Oh, I definitely want to play in a horror game with you as the GM now. Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Sweet. Well, so, yeah, we definitely, hey, we went long this time. And that is
as
okay
usual.
Because this was all, this is all some really, really good stuff. So awesome. Sweet. Well, yeah, I think this is definitely something we're going to keep doing with it, you know, particularly with an emphasis on the GMing of it, because, you know, even if it's a table and everyone participates in stuff like this, you know, one of the GM's main responsibilities is to ensure the tone and the atmosphere and everything of any kind of a game. So, yeah, sweet. So when we do this again, we'll pick another genre and then we will do another deep dive on it. Excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Danny. That was cool.
Of course. It also might be worth doing it from a player's perspective, too. Like, if you're playing in these games, what can you do to kind of help the genre along? Or what the sorts of things that can be helpful?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true. Yeah, okay. Once again,
because we're all working together here, theoretically. We're all working together.
Yeah, well, and I think we, even in a sense, we did kind of cover that too, of kind of basically, you know, if you are a player in a horror game, it's just like, yeah, feel free, step up, you know, like, you know, the more you bring into it, the easier it is for your GM to bring those horror elements in that you're looking for, you know, basically, feel free, you slip them a $5, you know, slip them a five spot, you know, like they'll take the bribe and they'll make it work. No problem.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Awesome. Right. Cool.
Yeah. Well, let's call this one and then we'll get going.
Yeah. Well, I hope everyone out there got something out of it. If you play horror games or have tricks for how to run a game or playing in a horror game, while playing RPG, let us know. I'd love to hear it. I'm always looking for tips and tricks to scare my players more than I already do. So when I have to skip a week, my players will always be like, well, that's doom avoided for one more week.
Yeah, that's right. I got some sleep tonight.
Yeah. But let us know. How do you run a horror game? Do you like horror games? Do you not play in them? If so, why not? What are your expectations of a horror game? Let us know. I'm always happy to talk about running and playing in horror games. I'm sure Todd will run into that conversation as well and contribute. So, yeah. And until then, until next time, we hope you have a little gaming in your magic and a little magic in your gaming. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
The Covenstead Podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Special thanks to all of our backers, Alex, Tim Brandon, Chris Atrata, Century Guild, Nicholas Diak, Fool's Moon Entertainment, Kaboom.com, minus five O's, no apologies, Brian P. Kurtz, Jason LeDuc, Civ Light, Revna, Derek Simsek, Danielle Thomas, Phil Watson, Jacob Wood, and Victor Wyatt. Thanks for listening. See you next time.